Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Lekkikatopoulos. I'm an emergency physician and pediatric emergency physician practicing in Ontario, Canada. And this is my COVID diary. Before we get started, nothing in this podcast constitutes medical advice. My views are mine alone and do not represent the views of my employers or colleagues. I was interviewed this week on CBC London Morning by Rebecca Zandbergen. If you are joining us for the first time after hearing that interview, welcome. If you've not yet listened to the earlier episodes in this series, please go back and listen to them first. This episode will make a lot more sense if you do. I want you to imagine something for me. A coin. Let's say it's a quarter. It looks like so many other quarters you've seen before. It has a head side and a tail side, and maybe it's a little beat up around the edges. But for all intents and purposes, it's a pretty unremarkable quarter. Now flip that quarter. But first, tell me, will it land heads up or tails up? Based on what you already know of all the normal, usual, unremarkable quarters you've encountered during your years on the planet, you could probably predict that the quarter would be equally likely to land head side up or tail side up. So you probably won't be surprised if I tell you that your imaginary quarter lands tails up. Now, we'll flip your quarter again. In fact, we will flip it 10 times. How many times will it land tails up? Again, based on your knowledge of all the normal, usual, unremarkable quarters you've encountered on planet Earth, you might predict that your quarter will land heads up about half the time and tails up about half the time. But we know that the math of it, the physics of it, the whatever you want to call it of it, isn't quite that straightforward. We might predict that the quarter lands heads up 5 times and tails up 5 times, but we can also intuit that if each flip is completely independent of the one before it and the one after it, each flip actually has an equal likelihood of landing either heads up or tails up. What I mean to say is that each time you flip your quarter, it has an equal probability of landing head side up or tail side up, regardless of whether it just landed head side up or tail side up on the previous flip. Flip 1 could land heads up or tails up. Flip 2, heads or tails again. Flip 3, heads or tails. There's no magic to the universe that ensures that our quarter lands heads up exactly half the time. So we might flip our coin and end up with tails 6 times, and we probably wouldn't get too excited about it. We might flip our quarter and end up with tails 7 times, or 4 times, and recognize that these variations in our 50-50 prediction of how often a flipped quarter lands tails up are the result of the randomness, the chance, that determines the outcome of coin flips. For the sake of argument, what if you flip your coin 10 times and wind up with tails 9 of those times? That feels a little weirder, right? Maybe it doesn't feel so weird that you think that there must be something wrong with the coin, some bias that makes it fall tails up more often than it falls heads up. But it might feel weird enough that you flip the coin 10 more times to find out what happens. Maybe on the next set of 10 flips, it lands tails up 3 times, and you feel reassured that the first trial was just a blip on the radar, the sort of statistical curiosity that happens when we live in a random and unpredictable universe where coins are unbiased. But maybe on the next set of 10 flips, your quarter lands tails up 8 times. Are you starting to get suspicious that maybe your quarter is not an unbiased coin that behaves just like every other coin you've ever flipped? How many flips does it take to convince you that you've got a strange and unusual quarter in your hand? If you flip it 10 times and it lands tails up 9 times, it might not feel like enough. But what if you do 10 trials of 10 coin flips? What if you flip your coin 100 times and then 100 more? What if you flip your coin 1,000 times and it lands tails up 850 of those times? If you flipped your quarter a bunch of times and convinced yourself it's an unusual quarter and lands tails up more often than you would predict, is that enough? Maybe you tell your sister and she's sure you've done something wrong, so she flips your coin 1,000 times also. Your cousin thinks that maybe your coin flipping technique is off, so he flips it 1,000 times again. Your best friend thinks that your family has a weird technique for flipping coins, so she takes your quarter and flips it 1,000 times. Her girlfriend thinks that hemispheric differences may affect the outcome of your coin flip, so she takes your quarter to Australia. Let's imagine a world before COVID, and she flips it 1,000 times. But her academic supervisor wonders if jet lag affects coin flips, so he takes the quarter and flips it 1,000 times. His son thinks that you haven't accounted for age differences in coin flipping technique, so he flips it 1,000 times and then asks his grandmother to flip your quarter 1,000 times again. His grandmother notices that most of your coin flippers so far have been right-handed, so she gives it to her friend who's left-handed, and he flips it 1,000 times. He thinks you've forgotten something too. But when do you have enough evidence to conclude that your quarter is an unusual coin that lands tails up more often than it lands heads up? You've started with an assumption that your quarter, which looks like every other quarter you've seen in your few or many years on the planet, is a normal quarter. You've assumed that your quarter will land tails up about as often as it lands heads up. How many times does your quarter need to land tails up, and under how many different circumstances, before you can be confident in asserting that your quarter is an unusual one? It's easy if your quarter behaves exactly as normal, landing about half the time tails up. That's probably a normal quarter. It's just about as easy if your quarter acts nothing like a normal quarter and always lands tails up. That's probably not a normal quarter. But if your quarter lands tails up just a bit more often than you would expect, it's hard to know what's true. Is your quarter a normal quarter that's just demonstrating some of the random chance inherent in the world? Is some factor outside the quarter causing it to land tails up more often than heads up? Or is there a signal here, meaning some useful information about the quarter? Or is it all noise, random variance with no significance whatsoever? I want to offer a hearty apology to every scientist and statistician out there for what I've just said and for what I'm about to say. Science is the flipping of a quarter again and again and again. When we begin, we have an idea about how we expect quarters to behave in the world. When a quarter violates our expectations, we are surprised, but we allow that unusual outcomes are sometimes the result of random happenstance. We may need to flip our quarter many more times, under many more circumstances, before we can determine whether our quarter really does behave in an unusual way. But what happens when we don't have much time, or when knowing whether your quarter is a normal quarter is a high-stakes question? Okay, so maybe I've extended the quarter metaphor past its limits. We're here to talk about COVID. You might remember that in a previous episode, I talked to you about wearing masks to slow the spread of disease. At that time, I mentioned that the Canadian government was not recommending the use of masks in public. Since that episode aired, Prime Minister Trudeau announced new recommendations to wear masks in public as a way to stop the spread of our respiratory droplets and maybe protect one another from contracting the coronavirus that causes COVID-19, especially if we are speaking moistly to one another. You might have also heard that in March, a French physician tweeted out a recommendation that we avoid the use of ibuprofen, sold under the trade names Advil and Motrin, in cases of suspected COVID. This was based on a suggestion of poor outcomes in Chinese COVID patients treated with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications like ibuprofen. The World Health Organization initially agreed with the French physician's stance, but has since backtracked. The Centers for Disease Control in the United States has said that there is no compelling evidence that ibuprofen worsens outcomes in people who are sick with COVID. We have heard that hydroxychloroquine, a drug used to treat malaria and autoimmune diseases, may cure COVID-19, but more recent evidence suggests that it almost certainly does not cure the disease and may actually cause more deaths. Maybe azithromycin, an antibiotic, helps. Maybe it doesn't. When each recommendation contradicts the next, what are we supposed to believe? Well, back to the idea that science is like flipping a coin. We start with the assumption that our coin is just a normal quarter. In other words, we assume that everything in the world works exactly the way we are used to it working. Ibuprofen reduces fever and makes people feel more comfortable, but doesn't change the course of disease. Hydroxychloroquine treats malaria and lupus, but doesn't have a role in the treatment of COVID-19. But then we flip the coin a bunch of times, and when we notice something seems different, we are surprised. We look back and see that patients treated with ibuprofen seem to become sicker with COVID. We find that patients who were taking hydroxychloroquine got better. Sometimes we find these things out by chance, and other times we have hypothesized that they might happen based on our knowledge of human physiology. When we are forced to move fast, we may not have the luxury of flipping our quarter 1,000 times. 10 times may have to do for now. We may make a recommendation that physicians avoid giving ibuprofen to patients with coronavirus disease because it seems like the safest choice to make with the data we have. We may recommend that physicians treat people with hydroxychloroquine when they're sick with COVID because people die of COVID and we don't have many other options for treatment. But what happens when we flip our coin 100 times or 1,000 times, or when someone else is able to flip our coin in a different context or using a different technique? Then our recommendations may change, and we may now say that ibuprofen is okay, or that hydroxychloroquine is probably not useful. It can be frustrating and confusing to hear so much conflicting information about COVID and to not know who to trust. It's tempting to cook up conspiracy theories or worry that the government or organizations like the World Health Organization or CDC are not telling us the truth or are somehow keeping us from some critical knowledge about how to avoid and how to treat COVID. If you don't know whether your quarter is biased, it probably doesn't matter that much. It's a curiosity, but the stakes are low. But COVID isn't a coin flip, is it? COVID is a novel virus, a pandemic that has hobbled healthcare systems around the world and taken many lives, sickening an untold number of people. We all worry that we will get it, that our parents or grandparents will get it, that our next door neighbors will die, that our healthcare system may be brought to its knees. We aren't just questioning whether we will come up heads or tails. We are wondering whether we will die. That makes it all the more difficult for me to say what I have to say next. We need to sit with uncertainty. The truth is that we do not know what will happen. Studies are being published at an astonishing rate. Some of these studies may not have passed muster for publication in a major academic medical journal 6 months ago. But they do today because they're the best evidence we can gather right now. And we need it right now. Studies that may be refuted tomorrow need to be published today because they show us what we need to look more closely at. They bring us closer to answers, of which there are precious few. We don't know what's true, but we're trying to find out. So, where are we now? As of April 29th, 2020, there have been 51,500 597 identified cases of COVID-19 in Canada. 2,996 people have died. In Ontario, where I live and work, there have been 15,728 identified cases of COVID. 996 people have died. Ontario just reported the lowest single-day increase in COVID cases in over 3 weeks. I hope you can hear me smiling because I have got a huge smile on my face. It's a hopeful time, a sign that what we are doing, these tedious weeks of social distancing and exuberant hand-washing, is working. But some questions remain. Our capacity to test widely in Ontario in particular, and Canada in general, has only recently begun to approach its potential. We've been stymied by a lack of testing media and few certified testing facilities. Fortunately, response at a facilities and government level has been brisk, and we're able to test an increasing number of patients, not just the sickest and those requiring admission to hospital. It's encouraging that we are seeing fewer identified cases coupled with an increased testing capacity, but we should wonder how many unidentified cases have occurred and then resolved in our communities. In a previous episode, I explained the concept of R-naught, which is, loosely speaking, the ability of a virus to infect a population. That ability is contingent on the population's vulnerability. If there are not many vulnerable people in the population, that is, not many who have not yet had the virus and are liable to contract it, or if vulnerable people are kept away from those who are infected, the virus will spread slowly or not at all. If many people are vulnerable, that is, they have not yet been infected, and they come into contact with those who are infected and infectious, the virus will spread quickly. Because we have only had the capacity for widespread testing recently, we don't know whether most people in our communities are at risk for infection or have already been infected. If most of our population has been infected and recovered, then the virus should have a relatively limited impact as we move forward, assuming that those who become infected subsequently become immune. On the other hand, if few people have been infected, then the latest good news may cause an abrupt increase in the rate of illness if we begin to relax our social distancing practices. Before we end this episode, I want to extend a special thanks to Mary and Hugh, the two medical students who are the brains behind this operation and without whom this series wouldn't be possible. Thank you to those of you listening with a skeptical ear and reading with a skeptical eye. Thank you for washing your hands and for staying home. Thank you to my colleagues who are working on new ways of protecting ourselves and our patients. Thank you to the many wonderful volunteers who've sewn scrub caps to protect our hair and printed mask extenders to save our sore ears. I'll be back with another episode soon. Until then, wash your hands, don't touch your face, and please, stay safe.